Good morning. Welcome to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. It is Friday, the 9th of February, and it is 9:12 in the morning. The government was open, and then it was shut down, and then they voted to open it, and now it's really open.
Just like 20 minutes ago.
20 minutes ago.
Back open.
So we're
open
fresh.
For business.
We're fresh open. We'll talk about that. We have a lot of other stuff to talk about. Let me introduce the panel to you. Oh, look who's here. Rich Honan is with us. He is a corporate attorney, our dear friend, and a man that we are very excited to see anytime he comes in the studio, but certainly today. Good morning. How are you?
Good morning. I am well. How are you?
I'm fine. Very nice to have you here. Always a pleasure.
Yeah, I can see I caused consternation in the booth because I didn't grab my mic until like a second before we started talking, but now...
So, everything's fine.
So now we're
everything's
all good.
Yes. Everything's good.
I see them all making arm motions at me, which is usually what happens when I come here.
Judith Enck is with us. Judith Enck is a former EPA Region 2 administrator. She is a current WAMC panelist, and we're thrilled to have you with us this morning.
My pleasure. Good morning.
Thank you very much. Good morning. Alan Chartok is with us. Good morning, Alan.
How'd you do?
How's everything? It's not that hard of a question, I don't think.
What do you mean by that?
Just right. Say terrific.
Terrific.
Okay. We're waiting. Malcolm Nance is going to join us as well, the MSNBC commentator, the counterterrorism expert, and he will be with us momentarily, best-selling author, and he is on the road. Just got a text from him from his car on I-90 and stuck in traffic, but he will be here. So.
If you're on Central Avenue, get out of the way.
That's right. Yeah. I don't...
Two wheels turning in WMC.
I just
studios.
Want you to know this for those entering or exiting the city, there is a mad former spy on the road.
Yeah, doesn't he just helicopter down and rappel down?
That's what I thought he did. Right. Yeah, well, he's going to be doing that. So Malcolm will be here in a few moments. Before we get into all the stuff today, and we do have a lot of stuff that has been going on, a lot to talk about, and a great panel to do it with, I just want to make mention our dear Judith here is going to be honored on Sunday afternoon at by Clearwater. Our dear friends of the Clearwater, Hudson River Sloop Clearwater, is having their Spirit of the Hudson Gala. They are honoring Judith for her incredible work. And not only, of course, at the EPA, but you are also have been a part of Clearwater.
Yeah, when I was home on maternity leave with my little baby Reed, who's now 30, I was the president of the board of directors of Clearwater, which
really?
Was a great honor. Yes.
Wow.
We drove a lot from Rensselaer County to Postenkill, baby in tow, to endless meetings. And so I really do know Clearwater, even though I've not been very involved lately.
And that was a challenging chair, right? I mean, they've always done wonderful work, but they've always had to raise the money.
Yeah, a lot of pressure. They do the annual Clearwater Revival.
Yeah.
Pete Seeger, Toshi Except Seeger
for 1 year.
Were amazing. Yeah. And Clearwater's a wonderful group, so they have a special place in my heart. So this means a lot coming from them. And so this event is in Garrison on Sunday afternoon, and tickets are still available. You could go to the Clearwater website, www.clearwater.org, or give them a call. And I really want to thank WAMC and this show because they're doing an auction at the event. And one of the auction items is for some poor soul to come in and join us at a roundtable session. So that'll be fun.
Joe, it sounds like you're just hearing that for the first time.
Oh, no.
It was Joe's idea.
It's a little extended from what we had offered. Right? I mean, we wanted them to be in the room with us.
Yeah.
I don't know that we
now
wanted
hosting,
them to be
right?
on the air.
No, in the room. Yeah. In the room.
No, that's what she said. Yeah. And we're very excited to have that happen. And and maybe Rich will be on the panel that day.
Maybe.
I think every panel
isn't that up to the person. I think the person
they can
who.
Pick.
Yeah, I think they may very well choose not to. Not to have to do that.
But thank you, WAMC. I know AMC has fundraising pressure to support Clearwater like that is terrific, and it should be a lovely afternoon.
We really love Clearwater. We do.
Yeah, they do great work. Yeah, clearwater.org. They're in the middle of everything related to the Hudson.
All right. Thank you very
thank
much.
You.
And congratulations
Thanks.
On a wonderful honor, and we'll give that out at the end. I was trying to do that and tread water a little bit, thinking that Malcolm would show up. But well, let's just get started.
Wait, I hear the helicopter.
I'll just say what he would have said.
At 9:14, he said he'll be here at 9:25.
Okay,
so there we go. Well, now that I know. All right, so let's go. Yes, you'll just say what he did. Sure you will. Okay. So there was a shutdown, and now there's not a shutdown, and things are open. Here's what we know as of right now. The president has signed the budget bill that passed overnight, which ended a very brief government shutdown. He sign it. I believe it was passed at 6 a.m. this morning. He signed it around 8:30. So whatever the reason was for that, we were talking about this during the break, of whatever the reason was for the for not immediately signing it, we don't know. Maybe it wasn't up yet. I don't know. But this year's first government shutdown began on January 20th, ended 2 days later. The second began and ended today. And what we know about it is Rand Paul was basically the guy who caused a lot of the delay in this.
He would argue that, though. He would argue that they scheduled him to cause the delay. He has to be able to say his piece at 2 p.m. when everybody's awake, and they made him do it late at night.
So I don't know what the rationale is for that. But let us just talk about the point that Rand Paul had, which I thought, it seemed to me, was a very striking point, which is you can, for years and years and years and years and years, beat up on the Democrats and say, you're allowing the federal deficit to skyrocket. You're 6 minutes early. You said you're going to be here at 25 after. Malcolm Nance is in the room. Good morning, Malcolm. Welcome. Hello. How are you?
The 90 is terrible today. Backed up to exit 10.
I know. But we're thrilled that
we
you're
heard
there.
We heard there was some speeding guy
back
in the car.
No, I think it was an accident.
Being chased by.
We're talking about Rand Paul, and we're talking about the budget. Oh. So just to bring you up to date, good morning. Welcome. All right. So Rand Paul's basic point here is you can't beat up on the Democrats and say deficit spending, deficit spending, deficit spending, and then pass this bill. You're being hypocritical, and that's stupid. How do you argue with that point?
You don't. He's absolutely right. And he had the courage. I don't always agree with the guy, but he had the courage to stand up there. And I think, I don't know, Jude, you think maybe they were trying to pressure him not to do it by putting him on so late? Or were they? I don't know what the idea was, but he's right. You know, there's no difference between establishment Republicans and establishment Democrats. The only thing they can agree on is spending money, and that's what they agreed on.
There was some weird procedural thing that they needed 100 of the Senate votes to move in a time period. So any senator could have done that. I actually think Rand Paul deserves some credit for his consistency.
I agree with you.
You know, I mean, the whole Obama administration, we would hear about runaway deficits. This budget agreement.
From the Republicans.
From the Republicans, of course. This budget agreement pushes the debt ceiling to 2019, and it is some very good domestic spending that I like. Unprecedented increase in military spending.
Let the record show that Rich just made a face when you said that.
Yeah.
A very good
not everyone could.
No,
see that.
I was nodding.
It was a nod. I thought it was a shake.
No,
he's agreeing.
I'm upset about the same thing you guys are upset about, which is it's just a lot of spending from a crowd that said, you know, we want to come in and balance the budget.
And it's a 2-year budget. Missing is any bill to protect the Dreamers.
Yeah.
I'm so nervous that Paul Ryan, who says he'll only advance something that the president will sign, I'm very nervous that there's not going to be a Dreamers agreement.
Well, that would be quite a breach of trust by both Ryan and McConnell, right?
Only Ryan. McConnell said he would bring it to the floor for a vote. It'll pass. But Ryan has consistently said he'll only advance something that the president will sign. And that means you have to get through Stephen Miller, who wants to do the crazy wall and you know, the term I'm so offended by, chain migration, which is essentially keeping families together. Yeah. I don't know how they're going to reach a Dreamer agreement if indeed it has to be something that the president would sign.
And I think there's a major difference here. I think Ryan wants to be president of the United States, and McConnell knows he can't. So Ryan is walking around with two buckets on his shoulders trying to please everybody, and that's not working.
Just a clarification, meaning that McConnell knows that he can't, meaning that McConnell can't, or
yeah,
that
McConnell,
Ryan can't?
I'm so sorry, Joe, you're right.
No, I'm
so
just
that, so that McConnell can't.
Yeah. Well, Ryan can't either.
Well,
but he doesn't know that.
I think you're wrong. I think he knows that. I don't think that's about this.
People forget he ran with Mitt Romney.
That's right.
Remember? Yeah.
People forget he almost didn't take the speakership.
Right.
Because he was afraid it was going to get in the way of his presidential hopes.
So what I have heard in the commentary in the few hours since this has been passed is that, oh, there's something here for everyone, in the sense that there is additional funds for the military, as well as for disaster relief for the victims of last year's hurricanes and wildfires. So,
amazing, because that's called a budget. And these continuing resolutions that they had been passing for so long, and you know, that to the point now where an actual budget passing is almost a national event.
And what do you think the reason for that is, Malcolm?
In two years.
Well, because of the
2018 elections, which they're so scared of?
Absolutely. I mean, it's time, you know, they got rid of earmarks, which they're talking about bringing back. But so now the payoffs have to begin. And there's no way that they're going to leave the Defense Department without the money that it required. They have to spread that largesse around. But, you know, going back to your original point about Republicans now being hypocrites, they don't care about that anymore. The hypocrisy is now a feature in their party, and they don't care what you think of it, because you can't be any worse than Donald Trump is. He changes his position every 30 seconds.
You don't think it's a feature of both parties?
No, not as. Are you kidding? I mean, the Republicans now have turned it into such a fine art that the word should just be eliminated from the dictionary, and they should just put a picture of an elephant in there.
Alan, you don't see the Democrats exhibiting any hypocrisy?
Nothing like this. This is weaponized hypocrisy.
Well, I think Malcolm makes a very good point, but especially because I think the Democrats have learned the hard way that they have to really be looking over their shoulders as to whether or not they are spending too much money. And the Republicans are total hypocrites about it.
For the last 35 years.
Yeah.
I mean, the deficit spirals up when you've got
But my point is, they don't care if you call them out as hypocrites, because the Democratic noise machine is nothing like the Republican noise machine.
It is not.
And the Republicans tomorrow, if the Democrats go back the slightest bit on one point, will come out and scream hypocrisy. And their people will automatically raise their ears and say, yes, that's hypocrisy. But, you know, so one side's doing it, the other side isn't. One side's trying to govern, the other side is just making a lot of noise.
I don't think that's reflective of the facts. I think both sides.
Holy cow, you are on a different set of facts than us.
I think both sides have been equally hypocritical, and I'll say both of the establishment sides. We were talking off air about, in a way, you know, you kind of got to respect Rand Paul for speaking for his just the way somebody on my side. I don't like her, but I kind of respect Elizabeth Warren. She, you know, she stays true to her principle. I don't agree with her principles, but she persists. But
thank you for saying persistence.
I mean, the Democrats. I heard Alan railed about it. You know, when the Democrats talked about, oh, it would be unpatriotic to contest the election, and they've been contesting the election for 2 years. The Democrats have said you shouldn't use the filibuster the way it's being, and now that they're in the minority, they're doing it. I think there's equal hypocrisy.
No one's contesting this election.
What do you mean they contested the election? You know, ever since Al Gore, who really, you know, was off the wall as far as I'm concerned, didn't contest the election and set this country on the wrong course as a result of that. And I'm still scratching my head as to what that guy was thinking at that point.
Well, if you hear his side of the story, he says he put country first, and he wanted stability, and he didn't want, you know, riots in the streets. I mean, I think he should have kept fighting, but that's that. But I disagree, Rich. I think as heartbreaking as it was to see Trump elected, you know, most Democrats acknowledge he is the president, and he is a nightmare to deal with. They're not contesting.
They don't like his legitimacy. Amazingly revisionist history. I seem to remember everybody saying, well, the Electoral College. We're going to have them not vote for him. And of
that was the way the system was designed.
And then the Jill Stein with the recount.
Very few people say he's not my president.
The whole Resist and Defy movement is all about trying to eliminate him from the presidency.
No. It's the policies. It's not the institution.
Resist, this nation was built on resist.
Yeah, Rich may make a point. It is all about, at this stage of the game, getting him out of there. I'm all for getting him out of there, and I think I'm all for contesting his terrible, terrible decisions, mm-hmm. which are so reminiscent of what happened in Germany all of those years ago.
Let's shift to Puerto Rico.
Okay, now, Richard, just shaking his head. Look at you, just shaking your head. Don't you want to?
I'll let that one go.
Okay, but we love having you here. We do.
Does it feel like it now, Rich?
Puerto Rico.
Yeah. Well, no. So funding, we have funding that is part of this. Not nearly enough.
And 6 months after the hurricane.
Yeah. Why does that get? That's what I don't understand. If it's something supposed to be emergency, quote, right. emergency or disaster relief, why does that have to wait? Why is there not a special bill for something gets paid right away?
There should have been. They did a modest bill. In September, they did a modest bill in October, but this is the big one. And, you know, there are some, you know, we're happy to have some money for Puerto Rico and the U.S. Virgin Islands. It's not nearly enough, and it came so late. So, for instance, I'm really pleased that there's language in the supplemental budget bill that allows for Puerto Rico and the U.S. Virgin Islands to rebuild a resilient, clean electricity grid. We have to remind people there are still 400,000 customers still without power in Puerto Rico today. Right. And customers means household. So it's probably over 800,000 people still without electricity. So now they have the permission to rebuild solar microgrids and more sustainable energy choices. I was just on the phone the other day with the guy in charge of energy restoration in the U.S. Virgin Islands. They're done. 100% restoration. Wow. No solar. They put up composite poles so they don't come down. So it's too late for them. So when the next hurricane hits, that electrical grid is going to come tumbling down all over again. So it's not enough money. It's something. They did good stuff on Medicaid. They did good stuff on housing, but too little and very late.
Yeah, this is called governing. And for about 5 minutes this year, they decided that they were going to go back to the regular order and govern. And I think that this is the fact that we passed this budget is actually a highlight to the dysfunction of this administration and this Congress over the last year. It's just insane that this is some breaking news item that we have a budget.
So let's remember.
We got a break and we will be back. We welcome your letters. Panel@WAMC.org, panel@WAMC.org. We will return right after this. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. Alan Chartok, Judith Eng, Malcolm Nance, and Rich Honan. Rich is checking the Dow.
It's Dow working.
Just checking.
The Dow is up.
A little bit.
All right.
298, a 1,000-point loss yesterday. We'll talk briefly about that in a moment. Alan, you were going to ask a question, Malcolm, before we went on break.
Thank you for remembering, Joe. Malcolm, the military part of this budget is astounding to me. We're spending so much on weaponry and the rest of it. A, are we spending it in the right places? And B, is it really necessary?
Well, I don't believe that the budget reflects the reality of what the warfighter needs on the ground. We are using some of the weapon systems that we have at a pace that is insane. Cruise missiles, for example, when we launched those 59 or 56 cruise missiles into Syria, those are $1 million each. They're worthless for the attack that they were launched for. They were actually blew up a few buildings when we actually called the Syrians and the Russians and told them to leave the base. We didn't destroy any of the chemicals that they were assigned to bomb. So people are using them like bullets. We don't have the capacity to sustain large-scale warfare that we might need. Prior to Iraq, the Iraq war, we had decades of bomb stocks, decades of missile stocks, you know, preparing to fight the Warsaw Pact. We're depleting them at an enormous rate. But that's not what all this extra money's for. It's not for new upgrades to body armor or vehicles. Some of these weapon systems are being foisted on the Defense Department. Donald Trump saying that he wants to bring the Navy, wants to put another, you know, 50 to 100 warships in the Navy. The Navy doesn't want that. They can't handle that. They can't recruit enough people to do that. It's really a budget which is just sort of a Potemkin village. You want to say that you have all this money in there, and then what you do is you force the Defense Department to spend it, and that means you're going to have an enormous amount of waste, fraud, and abuse.
So wasn't I great about this whole thing? Isn't the defense budget really the U.S. budget?
Yeah, I mean, Eisenhower and the military-industrial complex is possibly one of the greatest statements in American history. This is a man who was supreme Allied commander of the invasion of Europe. He knew where every bullet, every truck, every man was, and understood that when that level of warfare ended, the level of defense contracting lobbying did not end. And that's what we have, is we have people telling the president, you know, telling the president, we need 350, 400 warships. You need to be like Ronald Reagan. You got to man those things. You have to have a logistics chain for those things. You have to have bases for those things. Military housing.
Does it make for a better parade?
In North Korea, it makes for an awesome parade.
Yeah, but North Korea is also hearing about, or somebody, our enemies throughout the world are also hearing about the fact that, you know, whether the money's being spent efficiently or not, that we are beefing up our defense budget, and I think that
our enemies have been watching us fight for the last 20 years. I'm a war fighter. I have been on the ground in combat, naval combat, air combat. I've hit a freaking mine at sea. Our enemies already know our capabilities, and they know to beat our capabilities, they just have to go and do what we call asymmetric warfare, like hack our cyber grids or put out influence statements that support the president. They don't have to use advanced weaponry to get us. If we have an action with North Korea, we will be fighting with a 21st century weapon systems against a army with World War II level equipment, and they can beat us with it.
And certainly, Malcolm, the Russians know this because it's what ended the Soviet Union.
Sure, they've got and Russia has a fraction of the weapons they had under the Warsaw Pact in the Soviet Union. And they realized that their greatest weapon were these cyber-based influence warfare and propaganda systems. It cost them a few laptops and sitting down and creating a strategy. They use everything short of real war because they don't have the military capacity. But people are not looking at our defense budget and going, oh, America's going to come and beat us.
That's absolutely wrong. I think people are looking not only at our defense budget but at the leadership from the top and are not taking the kind of actions that they were taking during, for example, the last administration. I haven't seen Russia trying to expand its border, Russia expanding its borders any more than it did.
Ukraine.
You're not reading my books. I mean, you might want to take a look at television. Russia's being very aggressive.
Yeah, Russia was aggressive in a geographical way under the Obama
right
administration
now,
because they knew nothing was going to happen.
No, not at
and
all.
And those cruise missiles, I would argue, were highly effective in Syria when they put off, they stopped chemical attacks, which unfortunately are now apparently going on again, but there was a long hiatus between chemical attacks, probably almost a year, directly as a result of those cruise missiles. I think they were put to remarkably effective use.
You know, I think it was the famous writer Fran Lebowitz who had the dictum, you know, read before you think before you speak. And in this circumstance, certainly, I mean, this is my career field. It's my profession. And I'm going to tell you right now, everything you just said is topsy-turvy, upside down, wrong.
Have we had chemical attacks in Syria since?
Yep.
Well, recently.
And believe me, ISIS doesn't go around looking,
the defense
budget, it's $500 billion. We better stop our attacks. Since the beginning of time, all right, when one war-fighting group wanted to go against the other war-fighting group, they didn't count budget. They counted alacrity and adaptability and flexibility.
Absolutely.
And our enemies are adaptable and flexible, and our budget just shows that we are not.
No, our enemies still take their cues from the way in which we lead, and one of the reasons that ISIS expanded the way it did was the failed response from the last administration.
Not
sorry,
at all.
Judith.
I've only written three books on that
I just
matter. That's not true at all.
Shift to another important point is while the military budget
and take us away from this fun.
No,
all
no,
right,
no, no. It's a good debate for sure, but we have to remember as the military budget is increasing. The Department of State, the State Department budget for diplomacy is dramatically reduced, and close to half of the senior diplomats have left the State Department. They are not impressed with the Trump administration direction, Rex Tillerson, and in my mind, some of our best techniques in defense is diplomacy. And I think Department of Defense agrees with that. That's why they have come out opposing the State Department's reduction in budget. And it is a very serious situation when you have military spending dramatically increasing and diplomacy ability decreasing.
I think General Mattis is famous for saying that for every diplomat, he has to have three war fighters. And we're essentially changing our form of government engagement to essentially a Mongol horde type strategy where our spear tips do the talking. I have been that spear tip, both in overt, covert, and clandestine operations. It doesn't work that way. It's the discussions we have offline with our diplomats who actually resolve these things. All human conflict comes down to negotiation.
So I want to just mention that on the Congressional Corner, over the many years I've been doing it, I've talked to the guys who represent the district where the submarines are made.
Yeah.
Connecticut.
Yeah. And Groton.
And Groton and all. And in each case, Republican or Democrat, they have been compelled to say how important it was to build another $1 billion or multi-billion dollar submarine, because they know that the way in which that district and its commerce and its economics go is based on whether they're going to have the submarine or not.
Well, I think that's what Malcolm and to some extent I were saying. That's what's driving the budget is those bases are all over the country and they all have lobbyists. And that's what's dictating what's in the military budget as opposed to what's actually needed.
And those bases were designed. Most bases in the United States were laid out during the French during the Indian Wars,
They
you know they won't close them because they need that political influence.
Yeah, I was on the House floor or the Senate floor when they were having the debate many years ago. Was it the B-2 bomber? What was the one where the Air Force was saying we don't need it, and the senator from where the facility was says yes, we really need this program. The Air Force was saying we don't want it, we don't want it, we don't need it. Look, nobody's arguing in favor of the efficiency of Pentagon spending. I mean, I think you could spend a lot less money and spend it a lot more efficiently. I just don't even know how you start cracking that code. I don't know how you get under the mantle.
Lobbyists.
Well, the president is supposed to be a business leader and a good manager.
Oh,
it's not like he's managing the White House, but he could take a look at the management of his agencies.
No,
going well.
This budget reflects essentially the halftime or beginning military shows at Daytona and the Super Bowl, where they fly in Army helicopters and they drop in the Navy SEAL leapfrogs. And that's what he wants to do. He is putting up, he's taking real force capacity and he wants to use it for show. And by saying you have a big budget does not equal you having military capability. Our terrorist enemies have already shown that to us.
Malcolm, first of all, kudos for quoting Fran Lebowitz. so let's end with another quote. Great people talk about ideas. Average people talk about things. And small people talk about wine. We'll talk about all three when we come back.
Wait, what? What?
All right. Welcome back to the roundtable. And you're all right feisty today. I like it. We'll get back into some conversation here. Alan's got a fistful of butter, so we'll go to those.
Yay.
All right. Pardon me. Mike says, I find it ironic to see Rand Paul railing against the budget bill that increases government spending. Rand Paul also voted in favor of the Trump tax cut that will add more than $1 billion to the debt. he sure wasn't concerned about that in capital letters, and that's from Mike.
That's a great point, and that's what I'm really worried about, the combination of the tax cuts and the increased spending. I mean, this is not going to end well, fiscally.
Look, I'm not defending this two-year budget, but the one point we had made earlier about blowing the budget deficit on tax cuts is at least you have theoretically the possibility that you could increase revenues through increased productivity.
That's
what I bank on. Theory.
Arguably.
That's what they're hoping for.
And of course it happened.
That's what comes out of my ATM when I put my card in.
Well, you know, those 2 million people who've gotten bonuses from their employers as a result of the tax.
And I keep wondering what those dollars
I know, it's just crumbs, but to
state,
a lot of people, $1,000 is a lot of money. I would take it.
You know what? We had that discussion on here before, and I think we all came to an agreement after doing the math that it was actually $1.36.
Malcolm, if I wasn't here, you weren't having the discussion.
Okay, well, you go.
Tim says,
$1.36.
Tim says, question for Judith. Good morning, beloved panel.
Morning.
I'm wondering if Judith has any reaction to the news that the EU may stop doing trade deals with any country that is not a signatory to the Paris Climate Accord, of course, meaning only the United States. And that's best from Tim in Stone Ridge.
I had not heard that.
Yeah, I have. I don't think it's a very serious threat, but the Europeans are so upset about the United States pulling out of the Paris Climate Accord that they're looking for different levers to push. And they're saying they don't want to trade with companies or countries that are not part of it. I can't imagine it actually taking effect. I think it's...
U.S. is just too...
Yeah, it's too big. I think it's an interesting discussion.
It's just too interrelated.
Yeah, I'm not sure it's the right...
How do you pull one component out of that?
It's a good thing to say.
It's very good messaging. And I think whenever we focus on the serious threat of climate change and the implications of pulling out of Paris, that's good. But I don't think it's going to happen.
Good morning, panel, says John on Rand Paul. If Rand Paul really cared about deficits, he would vote against the $1.5 trillion corporate tax giveaway. He is not consistent. He's trying to have it both ways. Jay from Albany. And we heard from Virginia, who said, what an unfailing, self-centered man is Mr. Trump not to sign a tax bill. As soon as he got it at 6 a.m. this morning, it left government employees in limbo, whether or not to go to work, trying to sort their child care issues, transportation needs, work responsibilities and deadlines, possible reduced paycheck, et cetera. And that's from Virginia.
You think he has some empathy?
But why couldn't he get out of bed at 6 a.m. and sign the bill? I mean, then he could go back to tweeting and watch Fox.
He's watching Morning Joe doing Twitter. That's Donald Trump's routine.
Well, maybe also the bad
caring about
the guy who typically would bring him the document. The batterer
just got fired.
Got fired, and maybe they haven't replaced him, and there's a problem with paper flow. I had
don't
to get
ask why with Donald Trump.
Dreamers, says Charles.
Rich is just watching the show. Go ahead.
How many dreamers work in Trump's hotels, golf clubs, resorts, etc.? Will ICE deport them? Actually, I emphasized the them. Sorry about that. And that's from Chaz.
Would that include Melania's mother and father who came here under chain migration?
Well, that's interesting.
Yes. They didn't get their U.S. citizen. They didn't get their residency, then citizenship, until Melania was a U.S. citizen and got it for them.
So I have to share this little bit of Melania information involving the Environmental Protection Agency. What could the connection be?
Yes.
Melania's and Donald's nanny, who took care of young Barron Trump, the nanny's husband was just hired to work at EPA Region 2 as a special assistant, even though he has absolutely no environmental background.
So being paid off the books is your implication?
No, he's being paid $68,000 a year.
The nanny books. Yeah,
right. I always thought that the Region 2 offices in New York City would be a bit of a dumping ground for Trump allies. So Eric Trump's wedding planner is the regional administrator at HUD, and now the nanny's husband is working in my former office.
You know, come FYI. November 9th, or when the day after the next election, if there is a Democratic wave, those people will be quitting in droves.
Because why is that?
The only thing worse than being found in that position is to be found in that position and then have congressional inquiries looking into seeing whether you are doing graft, whether you are using that position as a position of authority, or whether you committed fraud in trying to get that job with the Trump administration or nepotism. It's going to be, one, interesting to watch.
All right, letters.
Okay. Good morning, panel.
Good morning.
I took this one a little out of order. Alan is absolutely right in comparing current trends in the 1930s Germany. The proposed military parade, when we have already had Memorial Day, 4th of July, and Veterans Day parades in most cities and towns, is a perfect example with the leader saying, look how strong we are, similar to highly criticized parades just yesterday in North Korea and in Moscow on May Day during the 1950s-60s, glorifying the leader and military hardware of honoring the men and women who have served, and that's from Roger in Utica.
You know what? Can I make a quick comment on that? You know what's just absolutely ludicrous about this White House in terms of their perceptions? This is the 100. This year is the 100th anniversary of the end of World War One.
Oh.
The backside left of the White House is Pershing Park, which is being turned into the new World War One Centennial Memorial for World War One. These people didn't even think about Memorial Day and doing a parade for that.
And I think this parade is actually going to happen. Mattis has said he's starting planning, and it's going to be like 2 weeks after this November.
Well, when the president says you got to do it, yeah, I don't see how you cannot do it.
And does Congress have to sign off on the spending?
Or? We were talking about that. We don't know.
It's a question whether it's in defense's discretionary spending or whether it's like the first Gulf War parade where it was 50% paid by donations. Mm. But that really interferes with training, manpower, rotations. Everyone has to be on orders. You have to sign out all that equipment, pre-mission maintenance, post-mission maintenance, and tanks cannot roll on streets. They have to go on transporters, which are really expensive to operate.
And here, this one's for Rich from Dan. Hypocrisy in both parties. Sometimes I agree with Rich, and sometimes I don't. Today, he is absolutely correct. Both parties are shamefully hypocritical. Neither party has any qualms about playing both sides of an issue depending on what they want on a given day. And that's from Dan in Pittsfield. All right. And then April says, great, a budget. Meanwhile, the Energy Information Association, EIA, projects our carbon footprints will be expanding. Federal funding for virtually any project that focuses on climate eliminated, and Pruitt calls attempts to address climate change, quote, arrogant. We need to act and soon, and so far we are failing miserably. You know, in my house, when somebody tells me we have to act, somebody meaning Roselle, what are we doing about this? You know, and I always look at her and I say, well, what? What do you want? You want people with pots and pans? You want people out in the street? What is it that people can do? They can call their legislators. They can call their congressmen. They can vote in the next election. What do you think?
Well, I've been saying the way we deal with the pulling out of Paris is one solar panel at a time. There's a lot we can do in the business sector, in our own homes. It's not a replacement for not having comprehensive federal legislation. But on the climate change issue, there's actually 1,000 things we can do absent federal leadership. The problem with the federal government is not only are they not acknowledging the science of climate change, but this administration is actively promoting oil, gas, coal. You know, I think we'll get to the issue of offshore oil drilling that may be coming to the shores of New York and Massachusetts and Connecticut. I mean, it's not just a matter of them sitting on the sidelines. They're making it worse.
Welcome to Potterville.
And here's one for you, Malcolm.
Judith, don't you think people, putting the government aside, I think people are really aware, and I think lots of people in their everyday life. And I don't know the cumulative effect, but there's lots of people who are trying to buy cars, either electric cars or cars that get better mileage. People are being recycling, just all the things that you're supposed people just being a little bit more sensitive of their carbon footprint.
So interesting, because yesterday I saw on the news that Tesla, which has put out 1,500 of its cars, has 500,000 something like
backlog.
Right. Yeah, Tesla says they're going to be doing 5,000 Model 3s, a week.
I just came from LA. Yeah. Those things are like
they're
taxis.
Everywhere. Yeah, they
California is so far.
And how far do they go?
Look around.
They go pretty far.
They go really far. Yeah.
200-300 miles.
They go hundreds of miles.
Yeah.
And they hold the charge.
They're going to have one go
cross country
pretty soon.
The problem in New York is there's not the infrastructure to recharge. That's supposed to be coming, but New York is really far behind California.
I know in California, at every supermarket, they have mandatory, I think, 5 charging stations.
Yeah, also in New York, every college has it. The other thing they have, I will say this, and I have to say this as the venture capital startup guy, when you have a company like Tesla that, first of all, is making that kind of progress technically, you have all these spinoffs. So now there's all these startups who are doing things like doing mapping for if you're going to drive your Tesla from California to New York and they are everywhere. You could stop it because everybody's got charging stations at their houses, right? And you could actually do that.
If I owned a restaurant, I'd have a charging station in front of it.
Yeah, most of them.
That's interesting.
People who can buy Teslas can spend money.
Hanniford has charging stations.
Well, these aren't that
charge
expensive.
Charge while you shop.
The new model, I think, is 30.
It's coming down to
the new model is
going to
be 38,000. That's the one they're going to be making 5,000 a week. They've ironed out, according to the journal, ironed out their production problems. And
I didn't read that they had ironed it out. I heard that they were going to try to iron it out.
Well, they,
which is a big difference. You know, the big problem, of course, as you just mentioned, Judith, is the batteries. Are the batteries going to be capable of doing it?
No, I disagree. I think the batteries are actually, they're making huge strides in the batteries. I think it's just pushing the cars out the door.
And remember, you can buy a hybrid. You can have it electric and fall back. And then there are some that are just electric, and that's where the battery issue is improving. I just want to point out, not everyone can afford a Tesla. There are other things you can do, like invest in mass transit, like walkable cities, bike lanes, and my favorite, carpooling. You don't have to like the person you're carpooling with, but you can improve your fuel efficiency.
Our national leadership right now abhors every one of those things you said. The perception of what they think this country should do is now being embraced by China. China is eating our lunch on every one of these fields. I hear now that they're looking to shoot to create their own model electric cars in that country. Right. And a billion people getting access to those, they could probably leapfrog over Tesla, if not steal their technology,
quickly,
and have those batteries funded through government funding.
Quick thing. At the White House, they took out the bicycle docking station. They didn't
what
want the people riding their bikes to the White House.
And on that note, we'll take a break. When we come back, we'll continue our lively conversation. Alan Chartok, Judith Eng, Malcolm Nance, Rich Honan. First News with Ray Graff. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion. Rich Honan, Malcolm Nance, Judith Eng, and Alan Chartok reading a fistful of letters. We'll do those, and then we'll move on to some offshore drilling talk, as well as other stuff right after.
Yay.
Oh, we have new letters, too. Look at this.
Fresh stuff.
This
fresh
just in.
Fresh material.
It's Judith.
Okay. Good morning, panel.
Good morning.
So let me get this right. Obama was weak when he got a hiatus in chemical combing without a bombing after Assad crossed the famous red line, but Trump is a true leader by getting the same hiatus, in quotes, with millions spent lobbying meaningless missiles. I'm reading article after article saying that the Syrian war is worse than ever. Speaking of hypocrisy, thanks, Anthony.
Yeah, the Syrian war is worse than ever because the way Obama got his hiatus was bringing in Putin to mediate the dispute.
God, that is so detached from reality.
Kerry was bragging about Putin coming in. Kerry was bragging about it. That war was lost the minute Obama walked away from the microphone that Saturday morning.
Yeah. Okay, whatever.
Kevin said, defense spending. Kevin from Melrose. Under Obama, total defense spending during his tenure was nearly $950 billion above what Bush 43's total 8-year defense budget was. The right loves to say Obama gutted the military. The numbers say otherwise.
Well, Obama put the budgets that were off the books and borrowed from China back onto the books, and it looks like a massive defense increase. No, it was invisible money under the Bush administration that was used from another country, and now it is back to where you can see it.
And Lillian says submarines. I think this is an answer to what I said before. I may be biased as the spouse of an almost retired submariner.
Hey, I'm a bubblehead.
But submariners are the future of our submarines, are the future of our security. The silent service is neither showy nor able to be paraded down the street. Perhaps this is why we are constantly arguing about their necessity, in question mark. And
you're,
that's from
you're
Lillian.
You're always going to need submarines. I've ridden submarines. I'm submarine qualified. I got my dolphins. I smell of amine when I open my old sea bag.
What's amine?
Amine is a chemical that's used to scrub the air, and it is a distinctly nasty smell. So we do need those things. But it's the excess, you know, the talk of bringing back battleships and all sorts of other ridiculous things which are not focused. They're focused on defense lobbyists, not the warfighters themselves.
And our friend Jules, who writes us quite frequently and effectively, says warships versus missiles. Question from Malcolm. I understand that the development of anti-ship missiles has reduced the effectiveness of surface war vessels. You just said it. What does the modern naval force look like?
He's got a really good point. What are being developed by our adversaries now with their tiny defense budgets are called hyperkinetic anti-shipping missiles. And these are things that go to Mach 3 and 4, go to the edge of space, come down, can guide itself to a warship, and will cut through it like a bullet goes through a piece of paper. And they're called carrier killers now. And we don't have any defenses against these things. Even, I think, Iran just started developing a hyper-velocity anti-shipping missile. Those are the areas of technologies.
Where did Iran get that money?
The same place they've been getting it from the beginning of time. Oil purchases that they've been selling on the market forever.
Some of it was $170 billion.
I have fought Iran in 1988, trying to keep the oil lanes open. So long as we use fossil fuels, Iran's always going to have buku money.
Okay. And Joseph says, tax cut. Good morning, panel. The fear of many economists is that the tax cut for corporations would end up in stock buybacks rather than reinvestment of their companies. It was reported yesterday that the financial news, that the huge stock buybacks have begun. Now that we've rolled back the tax rates so more corporations will pay less, will they still be allowed to take, quote, and no, not quote, but capital letters, refunds? Rich?
So is the question that the corporations are using the savings from the tax cut to do stock repurchases? I don't think that was unanticipated, though, right?
No, the letter writer says it was anticipated.
Yeah, but
I thought it was anticipated they were going to take that money, reinvest it back into their business, raise everybody's mm-hmm. salary, mm-hmm. and jumpstart productivity in America.
I think that's true. I think also that especially with the recent declines, right? You hit certain numbers where you say buying our stock is the best thing we can do. We're down a couple of thousand. I mean, cumulatively, a couple of thousand. We're up a few hundred right now, but I still think that those companies are especially things like the five year, you know, being able to depreciate stuff right away instead the 5 year things. But a lot of those companies are already issuing checks to people, and a lot of those companies are going to be spending more on capital spending. And at the end of the day, if the companies have more money, it ends up with the shareholders at some point, or the employees, or the vendors, which is what we want to see.
So while we got you talking on economics, can I ask you what's going on with the stock market?
Yeah. So if Aaron were here,
Aaron Pasini was
playing the role.
Why am I here? Aaron should be here.
And I cannot step into his shoes, but Aaron, of course, would say it's the capitalist tendencies of the market. But I think, and feel free to disagree, a couple of things happened. One, we actually had some good economic news, which perversely sends the markets down because people are afraid that that the Fed will raise interest rates and people will start moving money from equities into cash
like
and
Alice
bonds.
In Wonderland.
So that's part of it. Part of it also was, I think you'd agree, the market was pretty frothy, right? I mean, the market went straight up, and I think everybody kind of was waiting for some kind of pullback.
And so those
two things work together. I think the third thing is the I think we're starting to see these algorithmic trading
where it basically says,
you know, we're going to buy the stock and, you know, until it hits this, and we're going to start selling the stock. Yeah. And that's why you see.
And that's the volatility.
Yeah, the volatility. Mm-hmm. The other thing, now, if Rand Paul was here, in addition to talking for 4 hours, he would also say, he would say, I think, some of the things that you guys were making reference to, which is.
Something hypocritical?
No. He would say the spending, this government spending is also going to put more money into the system, which is going to lead to inflation, which is going to lead to higher interest rates.
But they didn't know the budget deal and while
I don't think that's a factor. I think you're right. I think this is a very routine correction. My buddy Ali Velshi on MSNBC says is that this is long overdue. Yeah. And then what you see is you may even see some of the automated. The first thing he predicted was that it was going to go up 200 to 300 points this morning. And that's exactly what happened.
Yeah, but it's interesting when it goes up 300 points as it did yesterday and then sinks 1,000 points later in the day.
Well, overall, it's about a 10% hit if you look at the
some of the people who shouldn't be in the market are now getting out of the market. And the people who know when to buy from those people are letting this thing settle down. When it hits 21,000, though, I want to hear what the president has to say about how it's returned to Barack Obama's number.
Right. And as far as I'm concerned, personally, it means I can never retire.
You were planning on it anyway, were you? All right.
That was a chilling sentence right there.
Out in California, new offshore drilling in California, according to commission, says it's economically infeasible, legally questionable, and politically a non-starter. This Coastal Commission on Trump's offshore drilling plan says, hey, it ain't going to happen. Meanwhile, back in the East Coast, Judith Ank has an op-ed in today's Times Union newspaper saying, hey, by the way, disaster is looming if we have this offshore drilling off the coast of New York State.
Yeah, so when I was early in my tenure at EPA, we had the BP oil spill down in the Gulf of Mexico. Thankfully, it was not my region, so I was not, 24/7 dealing with that. But I heard all about it from my colleagues, and it was months and months that they could not stop the crude from going into the Gulf and causing just incredible damage. And I have to admit, in the back of my mind, I kept thinking, oh, thank God I don't have offshore oil and gas drilling in New York and New Jersey and the Caribbean. But now we may, because Ryan Zinke, the Interior Secretary, announced he wants to open 90% of this country's coastal waters to drilling.
So unless they have a Republican governor.
Well, there's that one exception in Florida. But this is unbelievable. And I appreciate California saying they won't approve the pipelines and all the infrastructure. Structure and New York should look at that. But I think this is a very, very serious threat, and people off the coast are quite concerned. And so what the Department of Interior's Bureau of Ocean Energy Management is doing is they're going state to state, holding public meetings. Interestingly, the meeting for New York is not in Long Island, where you think it should be. Mm. It's in Albany this Thursday at the Albany Hilton from 3 to 7. And you don't get to speak. You just get to go from table to table and hear the information. So people who are opposed to drilling are speaking at 5 o'clock. There's going to be a rally outside the Hilton. And I think not only are we concerned about the impacts of oil spills, but also, from a climate change perspective, why do we want to ramp up domestic oil and gas drilling?
Okay, so these little veins in my head that are just pulsing when Scott Pruitt this week said that global warming might be beneficial because, quote, humans have most flourished during warming trends.
What?
That's the head of the EPA. It is so wildly irresponsible. Worst EPA administrator ever, not based on science or reality.
Can I make a recommendation? Before you go to that hearing, and if anyone is really concerned about about what you should be really thinking about with regards to drilling on coasts, go watch the movie Deepwater Horizon, which is a brilliant, almost documentary-like read of how cutting corners on that rig caused the explosion, caused, I believe, eight or nine people.
11 deaths.
11 deaths, blew that platform sky high and for a number of years contaminated and destroyed the Gulf Coast.
But listen to this. After that oil disaster, which I refuse to call it a spill, it was a disaster.
Yeah.
Over time, the Obama administration put some stronger regulations in place to prevent that. And 2 months ago, the Trump administration started repealing those safety regulations.
That hard to believe.
But I have this question for you, and I asked you this last time. In real life, and you've said the corporations don't care, but if,
in real life,
I'm not disagreeing. No,
whatever the hell we're living, but go ahead.
What I was going to say in real life. If a corporation knows that, for example, okay, I have the federal okay, but I mm-hmm. now want to drill off the coast of California, let's say California, mm-hmm. where I know that they're going to do everything they can, you know, they're both infrastructure-wise and every other way, why would they not just move on to a place where both the state and the feds say, you know, Alaska or parts of Louisiana where they already have it? Why would they just not move there other than for geological reasons?
Well, it's geological and also, you know, they can make a lot of money. So they'll do a cost-benefit analysis. Do we put money into, you know, fighting the state, trying to get the federal government to preempt the state, which happens a lot, as you know, on FERC projects. Right. And if there's a lot of revenue under the ocean, they're going to stay and they're going to fight. And it all depends upon who gets the leases.
But that's 5 years. That's 5 years of legal before you even...
Doing business for a lot of these
guys.
Yeah,
and if the states cut off the infrastructure where, like you said, you will not be able to bring a ship ashore. You will not be able to pipe anything out.
Right.
You will not be able to set up any supporting infrastructure. Right. Helicopter airstrips and control lanes will not be allowed to go out to the ocean.
But here's what will happen if a lot of states do that. This Congress and this Trump administration will override state rights on this.
Oh, my God.
Which happens quite a bit in this field. I mean, in New York, you have an Article 10 siting law, and the siting board has the option to ignore local zoning and local regulations. Will, I think, act that way. If enough is at stake, if just a couple states do it, maybe not. But, you know, Rick Perry is out, the energy secretary, trying to prop up coal, nuclear, and they're dramatically changing federal policy almost overnight.
Are there any states that have I threw out, you know, Alaska and Louisiana. Are there any states that actually have said, yeah, you know, we're open to it? I won't say embraced it, but...
No, I have not heard. I even have not heard that Alaska is that enthusiastic because they like what they have now.
Right.
Florida, as Alan said, they don't want it. And so Ryan Zinke, the Interior Secretary, said, okay, Florida's off the table.
Literally overnight.
Nice one.
Yeah, because they're concerned about the impact on beaches and tourism. Well, virtually every other state can say the same thing. So I'm happy they made that mistake because that'll be a good
and the mistake was quiver. by agreeing to
take Florida off the table.
Well, yeah, but the arrogance of this administration is they'll do whatever they want. I mean, you know, I'm sorry because I know I promised Rosemary a long time ago I would try to avoid my Fire Island analysis. But if you're sitting on the beach there, you're looking out there and you're seeing these oil rigs, it's not going to be helpful.
Yeah. I think what we're probably going to see off the coast of Long Island is gas drilling as opposed to oil drilling. And there haven't been leases to even look at this for 40 years.
Yeah.
Are they still doing tidal off of the coast of Long Island?
They were doing it in the lower East River. And they were having some problems that I think they fixed. I don't think they've gone to the ocean yet.
Yeah.
But we do have offshore wind, by the way, which would be a lovely replacement for offshore drilling.
But here's the point. In the end, and Judith, you've made this point again and again, in the end, it's not whether there'll be a disaster. Will be disaster.
Yes,
yeah,
absolutely.
And you know, if you're talking about natural gas, if you've seen natural gas rigs out there, they have to flare off the excess.
Right.
So you immediately not only do pollution into the air, it ruins your visual view shed going out there. And whereas wind can be put pretty far into the ocean. I was just in Norway. And where they have an enormous amount of wind and hydroelectric.
And an enormous amount of Teslas.
Yeah, an enormous amount of Teslas. But they make all their money.
Let's go to Norway.
But they make all of their money by doing petroleum drilling deep in the North Sea where it where if there's a spill, it's never coming ashore. It'll get be absorbed. But the beautiful thing is, they take that money and they make Norway pristine.
Okay, last 4 minutes. Rob Porter
Wait, you promised something about wine.
And Porter.
give me a minute.
After
give me
the show.
Oh, you're going to pull this all together?
It's a port. No. Rob Porter, so we, first of all, do we think General Kelly survives, number one? Number two, I was fascinated in the reading in the New York Times today that the first, one of the people that President Trump called about all of this is the guy he fired, was Reince Priebus.
Unbelievable.
Former chief of staff, which I found amazing. And what this was the guy who was supposed to bring the comm in, apparently knew about the Porter story for months prior. And then there's always the intrigue with because Porter is seeing Hope Hicks, who then drafted the messaging having to do with the denials, if you
defending the batterer.
That's right. So
let me in on this one.
It's yours.
You have the floor.
So where to begin? I mean, Don McGahn, the council knew, Kelly knew. They knew for months, but they thought this guy was a valuable part of the team, so they protected him.
And they allowed his stock to rise.
Yes, and he did not have the FBI flag list. He did not have security clearance. Apparently, there are dozens of people in the White House who still don't have permanent security clearance, including Jared Kushner. I read recently that he reached out to one of his ex-wives to encourage them not to speak to the FBI.
Correct. What?
I think we genuinely have to worry about the safety of young Hope Hicks. This guy has a pattern of battering. He's under a lot of pressure now. He lost his job. His reputation is in tatters. She should not have been involved in drafting documents defending him. Mm. Whether Kelly survives or not, I don't know. But I think being a batterer should be disqualifying. To serve in the White House and defending a batterer should be disqualifying.
Let me make a comment about the top secret security clearance process.
In one moment.
In 1 minute. A top secret SCI clearance, that's the minimum requirement that you need. It's three levels higher than general service top secret.
Yeah, okay? I had it.
And that is not even the special compartmented access special programs that he has to be cleared for. I heard about this a year ago, that he and several other people were quote-unquote unclearable.
Yep.
Unclearable is instantaneous drop from a job in any other position in the United States government. Donald Trump personally ordered those people to remain on station, personally allowed them access to classified information, and he and his chief of staff had to have known. The FBI generally tells you ahead of time. This guy should not be allowed near any level of government.
And who is Donald Trump except the fornicator in chief himself?
Well,
he should not be allowed in the White House. And also, he needs to not be, women need to know of his history. And, I'm honestly saying Hope Hicks should be careful.
I've seen those photographs. It looks like his go-to move is a hard right to your right eye. Both wives, two parts of the world at two separate times in history. The man is a wife beater. He needs to be removed from government, and General Kelly needs to resign. Because you know what? This isn't the Marines where you have some 19-year-old Marine and you're trying to recalibrate him. This is the highest levels of government with the highest level of trust.
All right, we're going to end there. A lot of very loud show today.
It's because I'm here.
good stuff, but very loud. Rich, thank you very much. Good to have you here.
My pleasure.
My pleasure. Malcolm, always good. We won't see you for a couple weeks, but you'll be back.
End of the month.
Okay, great. Thank you. And best of luck with you, and we appreciate you being here today. Judith, you're going to be on Sunday afternoon at the Garrison for a fete. For your fete.
It'll be fun.
It is
Thank
the
you,
third
Clearwater.
Annual Spirit of the Hudson Gala.
Is that how you say it? Fete? I never knew that.
Oh, that's the wine.
Yes. See, that's the one. Okay, go ahead. All right. Clearwater.org, clearwater.org. You can find out more information. Alan, what do you got going on? You got anything you want to plug?
Mm-hmm, go to sleep.
Okay. All right. Alan will be having a nap. You can find out more at WAMC.org. We'll be back after this.